I should not be here giving this talk. Nuria, my student, should be here because this is a project came from her master's thesis. Sadly, she's still in Paris since a few days, trying to get her visa, which she asked for a couple of months ago. So I left to give the talk. And this paper is on the archive today, and the talk's going to be in two parts. In the first part, I'll try to explain a joke. And in the second part, we'll try to explore a paradox. And the joke, the explanation of the joke will be an introduction of how people think about knowledge and knowledge of other agents in classical settings. And then we'll try to see, to transpose this to a quantum setting and see how all the axioms used break down. And in particular, then we use Renato's and Daniela's paradox to try to illustrate this and find like a real contradiction. Okay, good. So here's a joke. It's very bad. So three logicians, walk into a bar, and the bartender asks, "Do you all want beer?" The first one says, "I don't know." Second one says, "I don't know." The third one says, "Yes." No? Okay. I hope you like it. Because now we're going to spend 20 minutes explaining this. Okay.
Can you give the punchline
of the
barman gives each of them a beer?
Huh? No, the punchline is yes. The punchline is yes. Okay, I'll explain it. Okay, let's go through this. So, what I'll present here is one example that's very successful in modeling this kind of things. It's also successful in modeling things like the Muddy Children puzzle or all these hatch puzzles. And soon you'll guess the joke. Okay, and it's sometimes, I've seen it called model logic. I've seen it called epistemic logic, which is a subfield of model logic. It's not too relevant. Okay, so what's the idea? So the first thing we have, I'll explain just the different elements of this thing. So one is syntax. So this is the modality of it. So you're allowed operators like negation and some conjugation and implications. Okay? These kind of things are allowed. And then the whole thing will be about assessing the truth value of propositions. And propositions can be simple propositions, like in our example of the beer, we're going to have three agents. Yeah. Alice, Bob, and Chris. And each of them will either want beer or not, okay? So you can have propositions like P1 being Alice wants a beer. Okay. Bob, ta-da. But now you can also have propositions of the sort, Bob knows that Alice wants a beer. Okay, so this should be, for example, use KB to indicate that agent B knows something. Agent B knows FA. Or after, for example, what the bartender asks them is, do you all want a beer? Okay, so this should be the proposition I, which is, all of them want a beer, okay? And you can say, for example, well, Bob knows that it's not true that Alice knows if this is true or not, okay? Bob knows that Alice doesn't know that everybody wants a beer. Okay. So we'll be playing with things like this. Now we need a bit more structure. And this is given by this idea of possible worlds. So there's possible states. And here you could think of states where states like, okay. Of states like So this meaning nobody wants a beer, the state where only Chris wants a beer, only Bob wants a beer, etc. Okay? And this corresponds to a set of states of the world or possible worlds, okay? And then there's something in this Kripke logic which is called interpretations. So interpretations are maps from the set of all propositions and the set of all worlds to an assignment of truth, okay? So for example, the proposition, for example, this, which one did I do? Oh, if I take this world and the proposition phi, well, this is false. It's not true that in this, if this is the state of the world, that everybody wants a beer. Okay? Good. And then finally, these structures have one more element, which is a binary relation that it's a binary relation in the set of worlds, where this means something like this means agent I, given their knowledge in the world that we actually are, they admit that T is a possible world. Okay? So for example here, if we had, if this was S, okay, then okay, so Alice, all she knows in the beginning is that she doesn't want a beer. So for her, it's possible that nobody else wants a beer, but also that Chris wants a beer or that Bob wants a beer, okay? Okay. So this is just a basic structure, but now we need rules in order to play with it, okay? And in order to then explain what's happening in this joke. And these rules are the axioms of knowledge. And we will see, like, later on, comparison to Renato's axioms or Renato's assumptions. Okay. So the first one is this distribution knowledge. This means that, oh, I wanted to say just one more thing. Here. Just a matter of notation, if this interpretation tells me that this proposition is true in this world, then we denote this as like this. Just this is true in that world. Okay? And if it's true for all worlds, then we just denote it like that. Just simplification. Okay. So this means distribution axiom means that if I know something and I know a consequence of this, then I can chain my reasoning. Yes?
Before we move on to that.
Yeah.
Can you connect up your use of the KB symbol in your propositions to its interpretation and the possible world semantics? So
they will be propositions, and they will be connected by the axioms I shall give now.
So you're about to do that?
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. I'm not sure I completely followed this notation for agent's knowledge. S is what?
Okay, so this is, it's not, we're not going to use this actually. So this is the kind of the actual world. Okay. So this is a setting, everybody wants a beer. And these are the some world admitted by the agent. Yeah? It's a possible world. From us perspective. Given the information that they have then.
So T always is constrained by what S is.
Yeah. And by what the agent knows in S. I guess we're going to see how this evolves now.
So let me just double check.
Yeah.
Like what I'm looking for is something like KB phi A, if and only if there exists some world inside the set KB such that phi is true in that one. Is that one of your axioms, or is that just sort of a given? That's what you mean by that notation.
That's what I mean by this notation. So, okay, look, okay, so.
Phi A.
Okay, so let's try this. K I phi.
Yep.
In some world S. This means that for all t such that st belongs to ka, in all of these worlds, this holds. So in all the worlds that my agent admits, this thing is true. Yeah? Thanks for this. Okay. Good. So what's this distribution axiom? This just means if in this world S, I know some agent A knows some proposition and it knows that this implies something else, then another consequence. And this is kind of, it seems okay, right? Now this one is a bit, it may appear controversial at first, but it's just a matter of looking at it, right? So this is, if in all the worlds something is true, then all agents know that this is true. Okay, and this is, let me tell you why. This is the case, so this is just a constraint on what we admit inside the set of possible worlds, okay? So for example, here, they all know that everyone either wants a beer or doesn't want a beer, okay? There's no indecisiveness, for example. You could think, for example, you're talking about the weather on Earth and you're saying, well, there's snow in the North Pole. Okay, in all my worlds have snow in the North Pole. But then if someone comes along, if you also want to model the agent of, I don't know, a small child who doesn't know that there's snow in the North Pole, then you'd have to introduce another possible world in your structure, say, which does not have snow in the North Pole, okay? So if something is common to all the worlds in this structure, then what it means is that it's common knowledge to all the agents. Because notice that because this is a proposition, then it also follows that right. Then this is true in all worlds, so everybody knows that everybody knows this. That's it. Okay. So things that we will include in this when we talk about Renato's paradox will be things like the laws of quantum mechanics, like the Born rule.
So Lydia.
Yeah.
Strictly speaking, do you want to say that for all s, s implies phi implies that for all s, s implies?
Yeah, that's what the absence of s here means. Oh, so what I mean is this.
But maybe if you just write it out explicitly, like on the right-hand side of that implication, you do want for all s, s implies, right? Yeah. And then the same with all the other things, right?
When I have for all s, I don't put the s here. That's just notation.
Oh, I see.
Is this what you mean?
Your notation is that if you have for all s...
Then I just say it's true.
Okay.
Yeah? Okay. Okay, truth axiom. This is an axiom on what it means to have knowledge. So... So this means if an agent knows something, then this thing is true in that world, okay? Because you could think of this as this is just a definition of knowledge. Otherwise, it's belief. It's something that could be false. But obviously, this will give us problems in when we come to the quantum case. Because if you combine this and this, then it follows that, therefore, all agents Well, if the agent knows that this is true in all worlds, if I put a universal quantifier here, then this is true in all worlds, so then all the agents know this. Yeah. Okay, and finally, we have one more. I'll bring it back down. These are these introspection axioms. And this just means all the agents, they are very rational. They're all aware of the limitations of their knowledge. Okay, so in particular, if I know phi, then I know that I know it. And this is the positive introspection. And if I don't know it, then I'm aware that I don't know it. Okay. Of course, like, this is very powerful, right? It's very restrictive and shows that you cannot just go around applying this logic to like real life situations. Okay. So we can now try to apply these things here. Okay. No, I don't want this one. I want the other one. So we can try to apply it to this situation that we had here and just see what happens, okay? Just as an example of how this works. So what we know in the beginning they all enter the bar, and we know that they're all mathematicians, so they all know these things. So I'll just put some things here that are common knowledge first. So you know, it doesn't matter what the configuration is. If an agent know, sorry. Yes. Okay. Let's put this first. So everybody knows that everyone else either wants beer or doesn't want beer, right? Remember, this means this agent wants beer. Okay. So then everybody knows, for example, that if I don't want beer, then I know that this proposition that the bartender asked us, this is false. Okay. Okay, this is true in all possible roles. And this is the same as saying, but just by logic. But, oh. By just denying this thing, that if someone doesn't know the answer to the bartender's question, then it's because they want beer, right? So, does everyone want beer? If I know that I don't want beer, then I know that the answer is no. Okay. The only reason where I might not know the answer is because I do want beer myself. Is there a mistake?
Because the denial of the consequent would be not the case that Ki knows not phi. And now you.
But that's just, yeah, okay, yes, there's a step missing. Yes, you're right. And that's also the case. Like, if I don't know not phi, then I also don't know phi. Right? If I don't know whether I don't want a beer, then I don't know whether I want a beer.
Yes, okay.
Yes, so there's some stuff missing, but yeah. Okay, good. This talk is designed to make you thirsty. Okay. So then what happens when the first thing that happens is that Alice says, I don't know if this is true. Okay? So now suddenly Bob and Charlie know. Yes. That it's not true that Alice knows. And they also know this thing here. Okay. So then we can chain them together using the distribution axiom. To find out that Bob knows that Alice knows that Alice wants a beer. Okay, so this is distribution axiom, and now with this truth axiom, and this is all for a specific world S, which is the world of our joke where everyone wants a beer. And the same happens for, we apply the same analysis to Chris's reasoning. Okay. And now Bob says, I don't know if everyone wants a beer. So the same thing happens, right? So in this world S, Chris reasons that Bob doesn't know. Hi. And Chris knows that Bob knows. Hey. Well, you probably don't need this. And one. You probably don't even need this. But it follows that Chris loves that Bob wants a beer, and then finally Chris puts everything together and applies again the distribution axiom, and he answers yes to the bartender. Okay, good. So you can see how this thing is useful. And now we're going to see how what happens if you try to bring it to the quantum case. Okay. So, and we have problems right from the beginning. So one problem is that agents are taken as primitives in these structures. Okay, and it's very unclear how to apply this to the quantum case. So, because we need to associate him with some substrat. And then here, there are several options. For example, in a many worlds, in a unitary interpretation, you could assign agency to each of the branches of the wave function and say that they are different agents, or say that an agent is the whole thing that experiences everything. Okay. And also, this is one of the problems. The other problem is, well, what happens after someone's memory is erased? This doesn't happen in the classical case. Most people would agree that, oh, well, if my memory is erased and it's replaced with new things, then I'm no longer the same person. I cannot have... it would not be fair to assign agency in the same way. Like, consistently. And this is something that happens in the quantum case, although it will not be a problem here. Okay. The other thing is this possible world, which is very ill-defined. Okay. So in this case, it was very simple because it was just an assignment of three binary variables. In our case, we could assign a possible world with an evolution of a global quantum state over time. We could also assign it with possible sets of outcomes that agents get over time, for example. So, yes, and similarly, we have a problem with this interpretation that assigns true value to propositions that are either true or false for a given world. Okay. Third thing. Now starting with the axioms. So we have this knowledge generalization rule. We already saw that we can put all common knowledge in here. So in our case, it could be something like all agents model the evolution of each other's labs in a unitary manner. Okay, but not necessarily. Okay. So for example, if they use different interpretations of quantum theory, then you cannot include this in the common knowledge. Good. Now this introspection and this introspection axioms. They're very related to how you define an agent in the first place. So one thing that could go wrong is, for example, in a many worlds case, I get an outcome, I measure the sum state as in a superposition, I get an outcome, and now I need to decide, like, do I know that this is the outcome that I got? Like, for example, in the case of Alice, of our friend that gets measured later on, she could want to keep track of all the other possible outcomes that she got. Okay. And there's one way to get around this. And this is by, it's not pretty, but it's one possible workaround. The paradox will be to keep track of a context. So context could be anything. So it could be, for example, the time of the experiment, or whether she's keeping track of one branch or of the global evolution. So this would mean that now my interpretations, they go from a set of context times the possible roles times some proposition. So for example, a friend could think that, well, locally in this world, I saw some outcome 0, okay, and say this is true. But then also have something like globally in the same world, I am in a superposition of saying 0, 0 plus 1, 1, and I cannot make any assignment about this proposition itself. Okay. And this will be one way that allows us to avoid a contradiction, and that makes sense. The problem with this is that you need to keep track of like an exponent. Each agent needs to have an exponentially large memory on the number of measurements that happen, for example, in a system. Right. So this is the idea that I'm inside my lab, I see one outcome, but I also keep track of the global state. Okay. Good.
Sorry, Lydia.
Yeah.
You're allowing propositions be both statements about constant measurements and statements about the total wave function, or the two alternatives?
No, yeah, yes. So here the context could include, for example, could include something like local or global. So I can make statements about what I got here locally, and then statements about what I got, what I think is going on globally, and then this will maybe not allow me to change things in the same way. Okay.
The distinction between A equals 0 and the state of the mesh being entangled, you're thinking of that as merely being a distinction between local versus global, because another possible distinction would be, you know, if you want to make them more similar, you could say, I did a measurement, I got outcome A is equal to 0, versus I did a measurement of the Bell basis and I got outcome 5 plus equal to 0, 0 plus 1, 1. So when you write 0 plus 1, 1, is it?
Yeah, here I can, yes. So here, so in this case, it'd be, in the global thing, I'm not, so here instead of just mapping to true and false, I map to true, false, and undefined, for example. It should be just saying, well, this is the thing you said, so I measure it in the Bell basis, whatever. Yeah, and then if I try to apply this to the context that's global, it would just come out as it's undefined. The truth value of this proposition is undefined. No?
That's not quite what I was asking. I guess
okay. What were you asking?
I meant to ask more that is that when you, on the bottom line,
yeah.
when you write 0, 0, +1, 1, should there have been quotes around that?
And yeah, of course, yes. Yes, this is always sloppy, yes. So what I mean by this is, oh, this evolution went on my lab, or went on someone else's lab, and not they got this outcome.
So what I guess what I'm thinking is, you could, instead of saying the statement is this evolution went on this lab, you could say, Wigner's friend measured this lab in a basis that included U of 0, 0, +1, 1, and got that outcome. And I kind of like the parallel between those two lines would suggest that that's what you mean by putting it in quotes. Just like when we put, you know, spin Z is equal to 0 in quotes, what we mean really is somebody did a spin measurement and they got the plus outcome. Like if
okay.
you've just written 0, 0, +1, 1 on the bottom line, and on the top line written kept up along Z, I would have been like, okay, everything's consistent. You know, you've got quantum states for microsystems, quantum states for global systems.
Mm-hmm.
They're comparable.
Mm-hmm.
And if you put quotes around both of them and said they both refer to outcomes of measurements, in one case it's a measurement on a microscopic system, in the other case it's a measurement on a whole lab, I'd say, great, we have consistency. It's the same sorts of things
okay.
in both cases. So I'm just kind of trying to figure out, navigate in the space of all possibilities of what you meant. What did you mean?
What I meant is that I don't know yet how one would model this, if that helps.
All right.
And the reason why I did not invest much into this is precisely because of this other problem of like just this blow up in memory space that will be needed. The whole point of using this model logic structures is that you can compress all the information that different agents have. Right. And that's what makes it useful. And we cannot do science if we, well, I don't know. If you can, okay, I don't want to say this. Right. So maybe, there's only two axioms left to talk about, and we can come back to this maybe in the discussion session, because it should be fun to work out anyway. So, where are they? One is this distribution axiom. Okay, if I know something and I know its consequence, then I know the consequence. And the other one is the truth axiom. And so the two of them together are a bit like the consistency assumption of Renato's paper. Okay. Although the consistency assumption is a bit weaker than the knowledge generalization rule, because it only applies to statements of other agents that are not measuring each other directly. And the truth axiom is just highly problematic in the quantum case, so we'd have to drop it. Okay. Good. So maybe the last thing I can do is just to kind of rederive the paradox of the experiment. So in case you don't remember it, here's the experiment with everyone's names relabeled. And here's how we would do it. So the first thing is to say, well, what's the set of possible worlds / what is common knowledge here? And here it'd say everything. All worlds that satisfy, say, Bernatus' assumption Q, which was just compatibility with the Born rule. Something I'm going to call unitarity inside labs. This meaning that all agents model all other agents as unitary, which is necessary to derive the theorem. And just the setting of the experiment. Okay. because I'm taking this assumption S of the single world experiment, what I mean, I'll assign is each agent is assigned with a single outcome.
Properties of worlds or of theories that describe worlds?
These are joint properties of the set of agents and the theories that they believe in, okay? That they take for granted in the setting that they move in, the experiment. It's a joint thing.
So a theory is like part of the world in the sense because...
Yes, in the sense, yes.
Okay, so
yes. So if there was someone there who does not believe in quantum theory, that is part of this experiment, or one of us analyzing the experiment, then I would need to expand the set of possible worlds. Okay. The idea is just that this crypt is the crypt structure by fixing both the agents and the set of possible worlds, it gives us this relation. Okay. Yeah. Good. Okay. Good. So then, what we have? Oh, this doesn't move. So we get Alice here, which was some F or F bar inside the first lab. She measures the coin. She gets an outcome, which was tails. She knows what's going to happen to Bob, okay? And then she knows that, therefore, Wigner will get fail. Okay? Now, but it's not just Alice that knows this, because all the agents can reason about what's going on, okay? So in fact, and this is not only true, just like in the case of the beer example, this is not only true in the case where Alice actually gets, this is like the tails. This is not just true in the case of where Alice gets tails, this is true in every world. It's just implication. In the same way that in every world we know that if an agent doesn't know if everyone wants beer, it's because they themselves want beer. And in the same one, for all worlds, all agents know all the other implications that we had in the experiment. Right? So if B, so I think one. Then he knows that Alice got tails. If Ursula outside gets okay, then she knows that B is one. Right. And then? This is true for all agents, so we know by the truth axiom that these things are true, and every agent can chain the things together. Okay, so then it follows that for all worlds, all agents know that B equals OK implies still equal fair, right? And this is just by using the distribution axiom. And then we know that, well, now there exists a world, S, where both Ursula and Wigner, they both get okay, right? Where and who knows this? Well, Wigner knows this. But he also knows one. Well, he also knows this. Oh, therefore it follows And this, so in classical logical systems, what they want is a logical system to be sound, meaning that you cannot prove that something is true and simultaneously false using the same system. So inside the same structure. So you get this again. Okay. So I want to draw some conclusions. So first thing is, in order to do this, you need this assumption of unitary evolution. In order to do this, you need to assign, to associate each agent with one outcome only, okay? And there's ways to try to relax this. So maybe there's still hope of taking the classical Kripke structures and just modify the way we apply it here, just not be so naive, okay? Yes. I think that's most of what I want to say for now, and then we can maybe talk later. Yes, there's a question?
I'm just wondering, in this example, how do you respect the Holabay bound? Because you have four bits of information coming out of your experiment, but you only have three encoded qubits. So the Holabay bound would suggest you can't access more than three bits of classical information from that, those three bits, from those three qubits.
Is this a question for me? Is it true, the first thing that you said, that we get all this information out? Because I don't think that...
Well, the Holabay bound says that if you have n qubits, you can only access n.
Yeah, and what's the thing you said first about this experiment?
Well, you've got four bits coming out, right? You've got A, B, W, and U.
Yeah, but they're correlated, right? Yes, they're correlated. Yes, I think this is the answer, right? So you don't get four independent bits out. Yes.
Deterministically.
Yes. So. Yes. Yeah. Okay. So now, in a completely different, or not completely different, but just a slightly different subject, what we also do in this paper is do another analysis, even before we talk about classical logic, of Renato's paper. And one of the things that we notice is that there's this assumption that is used in the proof, but not stated as one of the axioms. Even though, like the way Renato described the axiom, it seemed to have it included. You said that universality of quantum theory, but what's in the paper is just the Born rule, right? This simplified Born rule. But you also need all agents to model the evolution of all other agents in unitary matter. Okay. And just having more distinctions and like also maybe decomposing some of like the consistency axiom into things like this also help us identify what's really going wrong. And more importantly, they help us distinguish different interpretations. Okay. So one example could be Bohmian mechanics, which now I think I understand a bit better. Because in Bohmian mechanics, you have like the pilot wave and then you have the real state corresponding to the actual outcomes people see. And while the pilot wave evolves entirely, the real outcomes, they don't have any rule that requires consistency over time. They're kind of stochastically sampled from the pilot, but in a way that does not require them to be consistent in the same way. So you could not model them. So I think this is what goes wrong, right? It satisfies the Born rule, it satisfies consistency. What it does not satisfy is some kind of unitary evolution of everything that's going on inside each lab, including the outcome. I believe. Okay, I don't know, we can see. Okay, I think that's where I want to stop now. Thanks. And I'm happy to go for the coffee break. Yes, do you have more questions?
Comment about it, what you said about Bohmian mechanics, because
yep.
It's actually quite interesting to look at this sort of experiment in Bohmian mechanics. I also learned a lot about Bohmian mechanics in these discussions, but apparently what most Bohmians say is that one should always take the perspective from the outside to the experiment, because Ohmian mechanics, I mean, in Rob's terms, doesn't actually satisfy the motility principle at all. Because if you actually model a subsystem in Bohmian mechanics, you have completely different elements. And so what happens in this sort of experiment really exposes the problem. So if you use Bohmian mechanics, and for example, from the viewpoint of the different agents, then you completely satisfy all these, let's say, implications that are there stated somewhere. I don't know. But these implications that I wrote down as statements, the things that I derived when I said, let's just use this module, and I think you pointed out, I implicitly should have made it explicit, also used the fact that it's unitary dynamics. But so they would agree with all these statements from each viewpoint. But if you take the outside viewpoint, then Bohmian mechanics actually gives really a different prediction. It says that the prediction that in this notation now Alice would make about the outcome of Wigner is actually exactly the opposite to the Born rule. That the opposite that you would obtain if you apply Bohmian mechanics from Alice's viewpoint. So it's really an example where if you apply Bohmian mechanics from Alice's viewpoint, you get one result. If you apply it from an outside viewpoint, let's say from God's view, you get exactly the opposite statement. And that was surprising. I mean, this is something that caused, I said, so many email exchanges. This was responsible maybe for half of these 1,000 email exchanges that the Bohmians were initially not aware of that, I think. But they now said, okay, then we have to decide what is the correct way of applying Bohmian mechanics, and what they said is that it should always be applied to the universe as a whole. And if we apply Bohmian mechanics to a part of the universe, then and it gives a different prediction, then this is not correct. So essentially, the Bohmian mechanics is a theory of the universe and should be applied to the whole. So essentially, they run into exactly this problem of the motility, movable motility, and then they have to declare what is the correct use of the theory. And if I now say they, there are, of course, a subgroup of Bohmians, but they would then say, okay, now we have to declare what is the correct use, and the correct use is the outside viewpoint. But that was quite interesting, because it's really a nice example of where this principle actually is not satisfied in an explicit manner.
So, Matt, are you
putting
as this group?
Pardon?
So, there's this book where
it said
Bohmian mechanics, so it should have been more specific, and then this paper by Anthony Sudbury.
Yes.
And
then
what it says is really like
the pilot site like evolves unitarily and then you just sample from it. And it's perfectly reasonable to think, like even without thinking of subsystems, that it's reasonable to think that, well, maybe in the beginning of the experiment you got outcome one, but if you look at it at the end, then one of the possibilities is that she got zero and this is consistent.
Oh, yes, but this I think is not
okay.
Because if you always assign times to the outcomes, then by definition they cannot change. I'm only talking about, for example, the outcome whatever u at time 30, and then of course it may change in the memory and so on. But if you really talk about the outcome at time 30, then this is well defined, because
mm-hmm.
you just look in the Bohmian trajectory where was the thing at time 30, and
mm-hmm.
you don't care whether it later changes. So indeed, you have the problem only in mechanics that memories can change. That's also an
yes,
indication
yes.
of that. But if you're really talking about outcomes at specific times, then it's well defined. Because then there's really just a Bohmian trajectory that tells you what was the pointer showing at that time. But indeed, it's a problem to assume that pointers remain, even if,
yes.
if according to quantum mechanics, it's an identity, they may still change. This indeed happens.
The difference in Alice's calculation and the God's Eye View calculation is that Alice's calculation uses an effective wave function. I think there's this notion in Bohmian mechanics
yes.
that you know you kind of have this branching wave function and
yes.
there's these effective wave functions that I can use and I can have those guide the particles.
Yes. I mean, Alice
that's
is
a difference.
Forced to do that. This
yeah.
Yes, but yes, Alice. I mean, that's it. In this case, Alice just regards the spin at the beginning as a quantum system, And of course, to assign a state to the spin, she has no other choice than, I mean, to use this term, to use the effective wave function.
Right.
So she just said, I prepared that spin, so it's now that spin. I mean, it's a natural way of what she would do. And indeed, from an outside perspective, you would now say she actually just used the effective wave function. I mean, it depends on where you start. I think this expression, effective wave function, suggests that it's not the real thing. And this is already indeed the view that Bohmians have, because they would say the real thing is the universe view. And if Alice now thinks she prepared actually a spin up, she may be wrong. It's a bit hard to, I mean, then it's already hard to say what that means, to say actually she's, the experiment tells her prepare spin up, but then the effective wave function is maybe not reflecting that correctly. But yeah, so the point is Alice just describes S, the spin, as a quantum system, and initializes this, or takes as an initial state the state she actually prepared, which is a natural thing for her to do. But then, if she does that calculation gives a different result from the outside.
So let me mention, there is a kind of precedent to this, like the failure of Cotillion moment mechanics. So if you compute what you expect to see, or what ontological picture you ought to have of a two-slit interference experiment, and you do it at the level of non-relativistic quantum mechanics, where you assign, you know, a Hilbert space to the particle's motional degree of freedom, you get this picture that the particle's in, goes through definitely one of the slits. And now you redo the same calculation using field theory, right? So you just say, oh, I'm going to model things from the perspective of field theory. Now you might have expected the particle description will emerge as a kind of an approximation to the deeper field theoretic description. But in fact, if you follow the Bohmian methodology, you get a completely different sort of picture where you have a field that has some weight of going through both slits, and it looks nothing like the ontological picture of the particle experiment. And so I think that's a sort of failure of cut motility at the level of the ontological picture of what's going on, whereas what you've got is stronger because it's a failure at the level of the operational predictions, which is more striking. But I just wanted to mention that there was this failure of cut motility, and the response, so this is a discussion I had with Anthony Valentini, his response was basically the same, that you should believe the ontological picture of the deeper theory, right? So the field theory, that's the right picture, and the other one's wrong.
Yes, that's right. I mean, there were also, I don't know whether this feeds also into this thing, that they sometimes have situations where the pointer variable indicates a particle has passed through a particular path, but actually the path variable indicates that it was in another path.
Right. It's a surrealistic trajectory.
So this is also related to that, because you could also say that's just different views on the same. In one case, you could take the pointer as an outside thing, and you would just look at the path. So I guess even from that, you could actually get a contradiction between, again, on the ontological things, not on the outcomes, because the outcome is by definition just a point. Yeah, so the difference, I think, here is it's actually about the outcomes and not about the ontological stuff that is introduced by Bohmian. It's really giving a different operational statement, which is then, let's say, if you take, of course, this advice seriously and say everything should be calculated from the outside viewpoint, then it's by definition consistent. It satisfies it because everyone is forced to take this viewpoint. Whenever I use the zero, I have to step outside of myself and model myself as a system. Then everyone has the same view. So by definition, the assumption C is satisfied, or maybe in your view, then there are facts really from the outside.
It means that the Bohmians have to take kind of similar position as the Everettians.
Yes.
So the Everettians would say, don't take too seriously facts that you think to be true based on living in a branch, because you're actually radically deceived about the truth of these other branches. And you might have thought that the Bohmians could avoid that, but in fact, they have to say the same thing. You know, when you do Bohmian mechanics from the perspective of your branch of the universal wave function,
it's
going to be wrong, and you have to take a broader view. You can be radically deceived.
Yes. Of course, they were always making the point that this is a very unusual situation, and normally it works. I mean, that was always there. It's, of course, it's an unusable theory. There's no, in practice, you can still use it, but in practice, it still agrees with it. So, that was it. Let's say, way out.
Practice, we can use collapse models.
Yes.
Practice, we can use classical theory.
It strikes me that it would be useful to have a book that gave everybody's positions on this argument, like the Bohmian answer, the Cubist answer, the many worlds answer. That would be valuable.
Maybe you could do what Chris Fuchs is doing and just publish the whole email exchange.
It's probably much, I mean, it was painful to write the emails, to read them would be just torture. I mean.
So maybe it's better to have
itself. Yeah, like the distillate of all those discussions was the final.
At least if I read what I wrote 2 years ago, I wouldn't agree with my former me. So that sounds probably a bad idea to just
do. I mean, what? Everybody eventually writes a response to your paper, and then you have a collection of viewpoints.
Well, yeah, I was imagining it might be good to force people to do that. You know, like if the Bohmians know that everybody else is going to have their response in this book, then they're going to have their response.
That's really
fun.
I have a question. Yes? You were the speaker. So, I'm just wondering about the approach in general. So you're starting with logic, and in some way, as far as I understand, the conclusion is that at the very beginning it fails in some way. Really at the very beginning.
Yeah, at the very beginning,
yes. So,
but it's not like it fails spectacularly, right?
No, but
it could be like...
Is that an indication that we...
What do you mean? I mean, what could be more spectacular than that?
No, but I mean, if we don't associate agents with a single outcome, for example, maybe if you keep track of the whole context, etc. Maybe if we let go of the truth axiom, you know.
But are there, so my question actually is there, are there other logic frameworks? I mean, there's quantum logic, I don't know what that is, but there was a term like that.
There's
that
nothing
actually
I could
take that serious and are already going in the right direction.
In the quantum case, we couldn't find anything. And I wish Nuria was here to answer this. Anybody in the classical case, they would all be variations of this. Of course, then you can have collapse with way of belief instead of knowledge. And maybe some of these things could be rescued.
And just the fact that there are these things that are called quantum logic and so on. So
yeah,
they're not resolving this.
Boolean, like kind of weakening Boolean logic and adopted here. And as far as I know, they don't concern themselves with settings with multiple agents and different perspectives and things, as far as I know, but if some of those are wrong, Oxford people. Yeah. It's shocking. Yeah. But I guess also until now there was not, until you were, there was no reason to.
What would be nice is to reason about this assumption, see and see what are the different flavors one could have of it.
Yes.
And as Marcus pointed out, it could be different. Like it could be violated in general, but maybe there, as I said, there could be hopefully a weaker version. But this doesn't even allow that, this framework, because it just imposes it from the very beginning.
Yeah.
And so I thought there must be some, at least philosophers who thought about theories of knowledge where you actually do reason about some. Can reason about consistency. I always thought that actually philosophers do that. So maybe we should be back philosophers. That they have these series of knowledge about others.
I mean, also in economy, that the case of irrational agents or unreliable agents or agents that are unreliable with some probability. And maybe there's something. I don't know. Yes, I don't know. I think
I'd
say
you
say more, right?
Almost, because if someone here, I mean, if there's someone knowing that,
probably
someone is.
Yes.
Maybe.
There aren't a lot of people who work on quantum logic anymore. And how old is epistemic logic? When, you know, yeah, the 70s, the 80s? I think most of the work on quantum logic might have.
So, Kripke, oh well, the paper I've got here. 59 is the earliest I have. Yeah, I mean.
People were doing quantum logic in the 60s, so maybe it just wasn't a priority.
Who was alive then?
Hmm?
Who was alive then?
But you know, it's a starting point for.
Yes. I mean, there was an interesting statement made by Marcus during lunch. And I would agree with that. If you just could do the experiment, and we could do it microscopically, we would probably all agree that quantum mechanics would be correct. So all these statements that were written down are individually correct. So the assumption that quantum mechanics is universal is probably something everyone in this room, I guess, would, at least to that extent, if an experiment is microscopic enough, agree with. And then this really implies already that the assumption C, or which I had, is actually, or must be wrong. Which is somehow really very unsatisfactory. And if there's no replace, so that's why, I mean, I say, okay, why should it be unsatisfactory? But we want at least to replace it. And it would be nice to have a logical theory which allows us to reason about weaker flavors of the assumption C. Maybe along the lines like, I mean, Rüdiger had this suggestion. Maybe it's only valid if the things are at the same time. If I could really ask that they're not counterfactual in the way. But we cannot even reason about them because there's no framework. Okay, that was just a comment, but I found this actually striking. You would just say, actually, we believe in Q, and so C must be wrong. It's not just a theorem.
Yeah, it makes it much easier that you abandoned what is first one, single bullet, exactly. So you have just binary now.
Yes, that was a.
Yeah,
sorry,
why don't you abandon?
So if you abandon this S assumption, then the theory loses any predictive power. That's something that wasn't clear before to me. But the only theory that would actually satisfy or that would avoid the paradox by giving up the single outcome assumption would be a many-worlds interpretation, which I think Jeremy Butterfield called the no histories paradigm, or no history slogan, where at any point in time it's completely unclear in which. So when I make a prediction now, where will I be in a second from now, then I'm just in any of the branches. So there's no persistency over the branches. So this typical picture that people draw when they draw lines in between branches, this suggests that in some reasonable way, whatever that means, we stay in a branch. And it makes sense. If I'm now in this branch and I make a prediction, it's understood that the prediction is in that branch. But if you give up these branches, that there's no connection, then we jump at any time into a random branch. So making predictions loses its sense in some way. So, I mean, there's no reasonable way to talk about prediction if there's no persistency over time at the moment. And so my own conclusion so far is if you give up that assumption, we just give up even the possibility that the theory can make any non-trivial prediction. That's why I no longer would be ready to give up.
Question for Lee. Have you thought about also considering formalizing the argument using the tools of temporal logic? It's a kind of modal logic where statements are time indexed, or you can say things like until such and such this is true and
we looked into this, it didn't. I mean, this is a specific type of a context, right?
Yeah.
Keeping track of this time information.
You can also think of it as specific types of additional modalities.
Yes.
So that you think of context as modalities.
Yeah. So
well, actually, maybe that's another question. When you said modality earlier, I usually think of modality as it is necessary that, it is possible that, it is known that, ways of being true. It can be possibly true, necessarily true, known to be true. But your context I wouldn't have called the context a modality. But modality is usually represented by some, you know, operator, like your K is a modality. Necessarily true is a box. You know, those are all modalities. So I think it might be different to introduce temporal modalities than to just say there are contexts that have information about time. Because context is just like saying I have another variable to describe my set of possible worlds. Whereas a modality like necessarily true is cashed out in terms of being true in all possible worlds, and being possibly true, being true in some possible world.
Okay, yes. Maybe. So we thought about how to put this, something, let me call it context for now, like something like, oh, I'm keeping track of what I see right now, I'm keeping track of the global evolution. And we saw that we could either put this as like a whole new variable, or we can just put this inside a proposition, or there's different ways of doing it. I don't know if they're all equivalent. I don't know.
In fact, it strikes me just now that mixing epistemic logic with temporal logic would actually be a really useful thing in certain contexts. So, for example, in some work that Matt Leifer and I did, we realized that if you're talking about, say, the collapse rule in the toy theory, mm-hmm. you have to distinguish what you know about the input, what you know about the output, what you know prior to learning the outcome, and what you know after learning the outcome. So there's sort of two notions of time. There's my epistemic time. What do I know before I learn the outcome? What do I know after I learn the outcome? But then there's the time of the system that is the object of my knowledge. And you know, the usual collapse rule we talk about is this funny transition between my state of knowledge about the input prior to learning the outcome to my state of knowledge of the output after learning the outcome. So there's sort of two time indices that have changed. But you can also ask, what do I know about the input after I learn the outcome? What do I know about the output before I learn the input? There's all these different possibilities. And it's a bit confusing. But it seems to me like what you've got there is this, like, I could imagine generating a, you know, muddy children paradox that would fold in, you know, different times, but different epistemic times as well. So somebody learns something, and then they have to make inferences of it. Like, it could get easily very confusing unless you have a formalism for disentangling.
Yeah, but I think you looked into that, and I think in this case, because the experiment is so carefully designed, I think it still didn't help, and you still got a contradiction, even if you kept track of all of this. Because, like, for example, in Dronata's original analysis, you do keep track of all the times and the time when I know when I learn something and the time when something happened. I feel that you do. And
today, when I wanted to answer, really was concerned that I should put even more time. I think I only put the time of the experiment, but not the time of when I know something.
Right.
But even if you do it.
Yes, and
I'll
try to do it, and I think
it doesn't help. In this case, not saying that it's not a useful thing to have.
I agree, this is very important, particularly to address questions like this. So, but
yes.
I don't, now currently I just tried this, I don't think it changes anything, because it's really like the time of knowledge is always coinciding with the time about which the statement is. So it's designed this way. I mean, this was kind of part of implicitly there when I chose these times. So why are these measurements at these particular times? Because according to quantum mechanics, you could move these times around,
mm-hmm.
and it wouldn't change. But they're actually chosen in such a way that you always make a statement about things that are valid at the same time as you make the statement. So, for example, let's say Ursula in this picture makes a statement about what Quark knows at the time when she reads. So it's very sad. But yes, I think one should be even more explicit there.
Yeah. Let's go for coffee.